As Jason Aldean was on stage, gracing tens of thousands of adoring fans at the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival in Las Vegas, a flurry of rapid-fire bullets ripped through the night from high above on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. Hundreds of rounds rained down on the concertgoers below. The first volley lasting 12 seconds, then an eerie silence. The music stopped, and the reality of what was transpiring began to sink in. Then the next eruption of gunfire. Many thought it was fireworks, as so often is the case in mass shootings. More bursts cracked through the night amongst screams of panic and horror. It was 11:20 p.m., October 1st, 2017, when a detachment of police officers breached a hotel suite on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino on the Las Vegas Strip, finding 14 AR-15 rifles, 8 AR-10 type rifles, a bolt-action rifle, and a revolver, all meant for a mass shooting months in the making. They were all confiscated. Whatever purpose they were meant for, no longer served. But unfortunately, it was an hour too late. For 15 minutes, from 10:05 to 10:20 p.m., that October 1st, the deadliest mass shooting committed by an individual in the history of the United States took place during the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival in Las Vegas, killing 60 people and injuring at least another 413. The ensuing panic eventually brought the total number of injured up to around 867. I'd like to give a quick thanks to all of our lovely OG supporters on Patreon who contribute $3 each month to help support the production costs of this podcast. Thank you very much indeed for helping to keep the cogs of the Homicide Inc. podcast turning. It's a huge help. And an extra special thanks to our Yakuza members on Patreon for your extra contributions to enjoy an additional 2 Homicide Inc. podcasts each month. If you'd like to become a member, you can find the Patreon information in the description of this podcast. All right, let's get back to the story. According to Stephen Paddock's girlfriend, he had been casing out Las Vegas Village repeatedly from different windows in their room while they were staying at the Mandalay Bay, a month before the shooting. Paddock's internet search terms from mid-September included SWAT weapons, ballistics chart 308, SWAT Las Vegas, and do police use explosives? The Route 91 Festival was by no means set in stone as his choice. Dating back all the way to May 2017, Paddock had researched large-scale venues in cities like Boston and even reserved a room overlooking the August 2017 Lollapalooza Festival in Chicago, but never used it. From the 17th of September, Paddock stayed at the Ogden in downtown Las Vegas, which overlooked the open-air Life is Beautiful Festival that ran from the 22nd to the 24th. On the 25th, Paddock arrived at Mandalay Bay and checked into room 135, a complimentary room on the 32nd floor. 4 days later, he also checked into the directly connected room 134. Both suites overlooked the site of the concert at Las Vegas Village. With help from Hotel Bellman, he brought 5 suitcases to his room on that day, 7 on the 26th, 2 on the 28th, 6 on the 30th, and 2 on the 1st of October. 1 day before the shooting, he placed Do Not Disturb signs on the doors of both rooms, as you would if you were planning a massacre. Just before 10 p.m., hotel security guard Jesus Campos was sent to the 32nd floor to investigate an open door alert. After discovering and reporting a bracket barring the door from opening, he heard what he thought was the sound of rapid drilling coming from room 135 and went to investigate. At 10:05 p.m., he was hit in the right thigh by one of about 35 bullets that Paddock fired through the door of his suite. Paddock had just used a hammer to break two of the windows in both of his suites and had begun shooting through them. In less than 10 minutes, he fired close to 1,100 rounds. Many people in the crowd initially mistook the gunfire for fireworks. During the shooting, police were initially confused whether the shots were coming from the Mandalay Bay, the nearby Luxor Hotel, or the festival grounds. And there were also multiple reports of additional shooters at other hotels on the strip. At some point during all of this, Campos encountered maintenance worker Stephen Shuck, who contacted hotel dispatchers and told them to call the police. Neither the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department nor MGM Resorts International ever confirmed when information about the initial shooting was relayed to the police. At 10:17 p.m., officers arrived on the 32nd floor and encountered Campos a minute later, who directed them to Paddock's suite. Between 10:26 and 10:30, officers breached through the door Paddock had screwed shut with the bracket. At 10:55, all guests had been evacuated. Police officers continued down the hallway, searching and clearing each room. At 11:20, they breached Paddock's suite. Along with the weapons in the suite, they also found Paddock dead on the floor from a gunshot wound to the head. What makes this case so unique, so prevalent in online discourse, investigation, and conspiracy talk, is that its infamy comes only partly from the historic massacre itself. A just as big part, if not bigger, stems from the no single or clear motivating factor conclusion of the FBI's over a year-long investigation into the shooting and Paddock and the police. Can such a horrific, unparalleled event really be just chalked up to, I don't know what to tell you? Or is it just that kind of lackluster explanation that would be used to cover up something behind the scenes, something darker? Who was Stephen Paddock? What or who could compel someone who, to those closest to him, seemed perfectly normal, to turn into literally the deadliest mass shooter in U.S. history? A laid-back goofball who didn't have a serious bone in his body, according to his longtime property manager, Lisa Crawford, who says that she knew Paddock better than a wife would. The most stable, even-keeled personality. He never even got frustrated, cool to hang out with, made you laugh, and liked to watch comedies and romantic movies on Crawford's Netflix account. Crawford said she suffered an emotional breakdown when Paddock was identified as the shooter in the massacre. Does that sound like a man who would stockpile 23 rifles to then relentlessly fire at a crowd of 22,000 people? Perhaps. Who's to say? Maybe it doesn't take much to push someone over the edge for someone to snap. Maybe it was all an act, a mask. The mass murderer was there all along, just beneath. Maybe he changed. Maybe it was all an act, a mask. The mass murderer was there all along, just beneath. Maybe he changed. Crawford did mention how she hadn't seen him in years. That's a long time, long enough for a lot to change. There's only one thing for certain. A firm and final conclusion of no motive, sorry, has pretty predictably proven to be historically unsatisfying. And a shitstorm of theories has been spawned in the wake of that lack of satisfaction. Now, to start with, the more broadly accepted theories provided by broadly accepted outlets. There's also the less broadly accepted ones provided by broadly ostracized outlets, but we'll get to those. Very early on, in the days following the shooting, an article was released by ABC News that mentioned that some law enforcement officials increasingly believed that Paddock had severe mental illness that had gone undiagnosed, though this was never confirmed or shot down. J. Reed Malloy, a forensic psychologist at the University of California at San Diego, who researches mass shootings, had said that his hunch is there's a secret life here that will eventually be uncovered, and Paddock did display one fitting behavior pattern, namely pathway, which is engaging in research, planning, and preparation for an act of violence, though no others typical of such perpetrators. Adam Lankford, a University of Alabama criminologist and researcher who tracks global mass shootings, said individuals who carry out such crimes tend to have suicidal motives, though he warned that without any explicit statements from Paddock, determining a motive is mostly speculation. Stephen Paddock's brothers have also spoken out about their sibling, offering insights of varying value regarding possible motives. Bruce Paddock, who had told investigators that he hadn't spoken with his brother for more than 10 years, said that he believed Stephen suffered from mental illness and was paranoid and delusional. Bruce himself was charged and arrested on suspicion of possessing child pornography on the 25th of October, 2017, just 24 days after the shooting, though those charges were eventually dropped. It's that closeness to the day of the massacre that adds this event to a series of, to some, seemingly suspicious misfortunes to people that were in some way or other connected to it. People that could, perhaps, have offered a viewpoint that would have gone against the official narrative. But we'll get to those. Eric Paddock, on the other hand, when speaking to MSNBC, said that there were no warning signs, no indication at all of mental illness that he knew of, nor any alcohol or drug problems. He said that if an asteroid had fallen to Earth, it would be the same shock to him as the shooting. He went on to point out that there was no political affiliation that he knew of, no religious affiliation that he knew of. He did say that he knew of 5 guns his brother kept in his safe, but was shocked that a rapid-fire weapon was used in Sunday's shooting, repeatedly expressing his desire that they find out where he got it, who gave it to him. He said that he didn't hunt and barely shot his guns, once taking Eric's children on a skeet shooting trip paid for by the casinos. The only thing that seemed possible to him was that his brother's head just broke. Did he have a stroke? He wondered. He then said that he hopes they cut open his brain and find something. There's a data point missing. A brain exam did in fact take place in 2018, but according to Dr. Hannes Vogel, director of neuropathology at Stanford University, Paddock had had neither a stroke, brain tumor, nor any one of a number of other neurological disorders that might have helped explain his actions. And here comes some conspiracy theory cud to chew on. As far as potential explanations that can serve multiple purposes, that can be used both to assign motive to the shooter but also to discredit and essentially nullify the shooting itself? A belief that the government routinely stages such events so that they can be used as pretext to impose stricter gun laws. Oh, God. In May of 2018, 1,200 pages of witness statements taken after the shooting were released by investigators, one of them standing out, that of a man who had met Paddock just weeks before the massacre and who was interviewed by authorities in a jailhouse after getting arrested on a possession charge. According to his statements, the two met when Paddock answered an online ad for schematics to convert semi-automatic guns to fire automatically. The man, whose identity was redacted, told law enforcement that Paddock had ranted about a popular right-wing conspiracy theory dating back to Hurricane Katrina, claiming that FEMA's actions during its aftermath were a dry run for law enforcement and military to start kicking down doors and confiscating guns. He stated that he saw Paddock as another internet nut, you know, watching too much of it and believing too much of it. He also told them that Paddock offered him $500 to help him convert several AR-15s to automatic weapons. The man declined, saying he was too old to spend the rest of his life in federal prison. He also recounted Paddock saying that somebody has to wake up the American public and get them to arm themselves, that sometimes sacrifices have to be made. In the weeks following the shooting, word of so-called key witnesses dying one after the other under suspicious circumstances quickly spread and circulated online. A long and undeniable body count, where people drew the connection between the victims beyond their collective presence at the shooting, beyond the shared proximity of their deaths time-wise to the shooting, all but one occurring in the same month of October, and even that one just 2 days into November. The main claim is that they all gave accounts that in some way conflicted with and often challenged the mainstream media and law enforcement's official version of the events. First, there's the Carvers, Dennis and Lorraine. The married couple was killed 15 days after the shooting on October 16th when their car veered off the road, crashing into a metal gate and catching fire. Both were pronounced dead at the scene. Lorraine Carver was amongst the witnesses that had posted, either by misinformation or by witnessing, about there being shooters as opposed to just one. Additionally, there's a lot of speculation regarding the alleged confiscation of witnesses' phones and laptops by the FBI. When it comes to the Carvers, Dennis's phone apparently showed up on their doorstep a week after the fatal crash, after he had lost it during the confusion of the shooting, and it had somehow ended up in the FBI's possession. According to the couple's daughter, Brooke Carver, all his photos and messages were still there. This came in light of several workers at the Route 91 Festival getting their cell phones back, and every single one of them saying that all of their phones had been completely wiped clean, according to archived images of an anonymous woman's posts on Facebook. A man claiming to have been the beverage manager for the event replied to the post, confirming it, adding that his laptop was also wiped clean. 2 points stood out to skeptics as worthwhile. 1. The question of if every device was indeed wiped, as has been reported to be standard procedure, why Dennis's phone was returned seemingly intact. 2. The observation that even if something had been deleted, something the Carvers weren't supposed to have seen, the only ones that would have been able to tell were Dennis and Lorraine. That was enough. Theories swirled, the most popular one involving the CIA's ability to remotely hack into a car's controls, as revealed in WikiLeaks' Vault 7 dumps, and drawing parallels to the death of investigative journalist Michael Hastings in 2013, also in a car crash. In the same week, on the 23rd of October, 35-year-old Danny Contreras was found in an abandoned house in the Northeastern Valley with multiple gunshot wounds. Police said they believe the homicide was narcotics-related. The day after the attack, a Twitter account by the name of Danny Contreras tweeted about feeling lucky to be alive and two men having chased him with guns. The account was automatically assumed to belong to the same deceased Danny Contreras. However, upon further examination, the image attached to that Twitter account does not match an image associated with a fundraiser for the murdered Danny Contreras, launched on October 25th. The account has since been suspended. Now, perhaps the most disturbing one is that of 60-year-old John Beelman. Only 3 days after the massacre, on October 4th, Beelman shot and killed his severely disabled, wheelchair-bound 27-year-old daughter in the backyard of their home in Fairport, New York, before turning the gun on himself. Though various lofty claims were made about Beelman's connection to the shooting, and to Paddock in specific, they all turned out to be fabricated. Neither was there any charger or communications device of his discovered in Paddock's room, nor was he ever wanted for questioning by the FBI. Cited as the most publicized death following the shooting, 28-year-old Kimberly Suchamel was found dead at her home 8 days after, on October 9th. Kimberly's grandmother, who found her, believes that Kimberly passed away in her sleep, saying she believed the stress from the shooting took her life. According to her, Kimberly, who was not injured during the shooting, suffered from seizures and was taking medication for a tumor. Kimberly had also shared her fear of falling asleep at night, as the sounds of gunfire would become louder in her head, and the images of broken and bloodied bodies would flash through her mind. What makes Kimberly stand out and draw the interest of theorists is a long, detailed Facebook post of hers that went viral following the shooting, in which she very explicitly questions and contradicts the established narrative of Stephen Paddock being the lone shooter, talking about how multiple gunmen were not only firing weapons at the crowd, but chasing people and gunning them down. Her post features an account of how she was chased by one of the shooters, and repeatedly emphasizing the point that there were multiple shooters, writing that they couldn't hide because they, and I do mean they, were chasing them, describing how she kept looking back, expecting to see the gunmen, and specifying men because there was more than one person, and again that there was more than one gun firing. 100% more than one, she wrote. She went on to point out that every single survivor she had talked to also remembers multiple shooters, and at least one from the ground. Why aren't we being taken more seriously? Tons of things don't add up. She also directly called out the reporting by mainstream news outlets, saying how the story that they are feeding everyone doesn't add up to eyewitness accounts. There is something wrong with what they are saying, and the evidence seems fake if you ask me. End quote. Finally, she referenced an incident that apparently multiple people had talked about, and that she claimed had been suppressed, namely of a lady towards the beginning of the evening who had made her way up to the stage, warning people they were all going to die. This woman was noticed by other event-goers too. One event-goer described the same incident as Kimberly in an interview with Sky News. Kimberly's Facebook post was deleted following her death. One of these cases is about a person who wasn't actually there on the ground being shot at, but to a lot of theorists, is perhaps the most intriguing one, that of Jason Aldean's attorney, Orville Almon, who also represented the festival. Almon was found dead on the 2nd of November at age 66, described by local Nashville media as seizure during sleep, which many were quick to jump on, citing the similarities with Kimberly Suchamel's death. As an attorney, Almon was apparently renowned for negotiating with law enforcement, and yet he had allegedly, in a thread on Facebook that has since been made private, described his meetings with MGM, Las Vegas police, and the FBI in relation to the shooting as incredibly strange and complex, added onto a widespread assumption by reports and people online that it was widely known that he was privy to inside information that the FBI, by announcing they are no longer holding press conferences and the investigation is closed, have chosen to withhold from the public. There was one more death which was falsely reported, that of Chad Nishimura, a Mandalay Bay hotel worker. After first having falsely been reported as missing, he was falsely reported as having been murdered outside of a Las Vegas church, though that never happened. A man was murdered there on the 16th of October, but it wasn't Nishimura. It was a guy named Hector Flores. Outside of the online circles where they originated, beyond some YouTube videos and the occasional anomaly that was a mainstream outlet parroting some facet before it was promptly debunked and taken down, none of these theories ever gained the traction or broad acceptance needed to truly impact real-world developments. either due to a genuine lack of evidence or due to a successful cover-up, either side will forever claim the other. Some other case, some other time, that might have been where it ended. But not here, not now. By now, we've seen the usually inverse relationship between the drama and explosiveness of a theory and the credibility of its originators, who it's touted by, anonymous users, rambling commenters, disreputable news sites, disreputable figures. How about a dramatic and explosive theory that's touted by a former Pentagon and National Security Council official and a retired CIA agent? According to Rich Higgins and Brad Johnson, Paddock's rampage was in fact a coordinated anti-Trump plot involving, get this, the Islamic State and Antifa. 1 month after the shooting, Johnson, Higgins, and a handful of associates collaborated on a 51-page PowerPoint document based, according to its executive summary, on open-source information with tactical counterterrorism analysis, cyber intelligence, and digital data mining capabilities. To these two once-intelligence insiders, the motivating factor was, in Higgins' words, anti-Trump bias. They both espoused the theory, which had circulated and spread rapidly as online rumor, that Paddock was a registered Democrat in Florida, and that his choice of country music singer Jason Aldean's performance as the time and place for his attack was far from random, but that he specifically targeted country music fans due to the broad perception of that demographic being a natural Trump voting bloc. The greatest indicator to Higgins, however, was the timing of Paddock's purchasing of dozens of weapons and thousands of rounds of ammunition right before Trump's election. When confronted during an interview with Politico with law enforcement's final report finding no evidence to link Paddock to any terrorists, Johnson made it a point to differentiate between what, to him, is being said and what is meant, specifying that when law enforcement states that they have found no evidence of terrorist involvement, what they're actually saying is that they have found no evidence at the level of proof, while at the level of intelligence, it's, quote, frickin' chin deep in it. Higgins has also made the claim that the FBI has placed everyone knowledgeable on the Las Vegas shooting under a gag order with threats of polygraphs. The main course, though, the selling point, the big draw of the report, was the assertion that Paddock didn't in fact kill himself, but that he was taken out by a collaborator in the room with him in an op gone bad. The alleged collaborator's name was included in the document, Brian Hodge. Hodge was in Vegas on business the night of the shooting, staying in the same hotel as Paddock. Johnson and Higgins describe him as the go-between ISIS and Antifa, though the information publicly available from the document regarding the arguments and substance to support their assertions is pretty much non-existent. In their Politico interview, only his support for some left-wing issues, such as transgender rights and gay marriage, along with some anti-right-wing views, is referenced, in addition to apparently having eaten at a Turkish doner kebab store in New Mexico the day after the shooting, which Hodge denies. His act of making his social media accounts private, as well as alleged deletion of content, which Hodge denies, is also brought up in the report as the purposeful deletion of data and attempting to conceal his electronic social media presence, showcasing evidence of guilt. So much so that they recommended Hodge be put under national-level surveillance by FISA. That's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, started in 1978. And basically, it restricts the circumstances of when a U.S. government agency can perform a warrantless surveillance and allows the government to investigate terrorism while preventing the illegal invasion of privacy of U.S. citizens. Now, Hodge didn't exactly help himself either. While the shooting was still ongoing, he went on Facebook and just started posting about things he really should have no idea about, commenting as if he was on site, which he wasn't, talking about a shooter looking Asian, about there being SWAT teams everywhere, and claiming at one point that there were multiple shooters with automatic weapons. He later corrected himself on this, which some users in the comments instantly jumped at, asking if they told him to backpedal. And then, on top of all that, he said that the shooter's hotel room was right next to his, when in fact, they were just on the same floor. He was more like right there with a shovel in hand, digging his own grave alongside Higgins and Johnson. Sloppy misstatements or massive slip-ups? It seems like this is a case so momentous and earth-shattering that it has either made everyone involved with it paranoid, or one that has been made to seem much more momentous and earth-shattering than it actually is by already paranoid people. Well, only 5 years after, it's already become a pretty established online tradition that once every few months, someone will post something to the extent of, "Hey, isn't it kind of insane that the worst mass shooting in the history of the United States happened in Vegas in 2017, and there's still no motive for it?" A tradition that, by the looks of it, will only grow more and more established as the years go by. Well, thank you very much for tuning in to the Homicide Inc. True Crime Podcast. I'd like to invite you to rate this podcast, whether it's on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening from. Be a pal and click the stars and leave a review if you would. This helps us tremendously in getting our podcast into more ears. Also, make sure you subscribe so you'll get notifications as soon as a new episode is released. And be sure to check out our Patreon campaign for exclusive Homicide Inc. podcasts that are available first to patrons. That information is in the description of this podcast. If you have a compelling true crime story you'd like me to consider investigating, please send me an email. And if you'd like to help support the production costs of the Homicide Inc. podcast, you can always buy us a coffee. Those details are also in the description and on the Homicide Inc. website, where you can hear all the podcasts and some other cool stuff. Well, thanks, guys, and we'll see you again very soon. Ciao for now.